The JMU journalism team bring you the Liverpool Life podcast.
Hello, I'm Natalie McGill, and welcome to this week's Liverpool Life podcast. I'll be keeping you up to date on all of this week's news and sport, along with a guide of what's happening this weekend in Liverpool. Here on the podcast, we have an exclusive access to one of the biggest showcases in the world, and we will be bringing you interviews with the people behind the screen who produce some of the biggest TV worldwide hits.
Fab! That's what I think.
I think it's so brilliant. And my first thought, actually, was a really lovely thought, and that is that that television ain't dead.
And television is certainly not dead. Stay tuned to find out how broadcast programmes could be tailored in the near future to accommodate our individual moods and even lives.
There's ways to engage an audience in a living room which don't require a screen.
But first, on Thursday of this week, Storm Doris crashed into Liverpool, with high winds and sea levels causing spectacular scenes in the city, and especially on the waterfront, with the port closed and the Albert Dock taking a real battering. But fortunately, the weather earlier in the week was calm enough for the red carpet to be rolled out in front of the ACC Convention Centre for where BBC Worldwide held their annual showcase. Lucy Fagan has the exclusive on one of the biggest showcases in the world.
Liverpool has been in the TV spotlight this week as BBC's 41st annual worldwide showcase came to the city. Stars such as Joanna Lumley, Matt LeBlanc and Danny Minogue were all at the event focused at distributing the BBC's content across the globe. Monday night saw a red carpet event for the exclusive industry event with national media coverage before the real hustling for shows began. Their convention centre, which was under top security and no filming allowed, was filled with 600 digibooths. What are digibooths, I hear you ask? Well, they're cornered off computers holding 50,000 hours worth of programming, all covering shows such as Sherlock, Blue Planet 2 and new Louis Theroux documentaries. Industry executives from global brands such as Amazon and Netflix all sat intently across the room watching new shows which are currently in development. The unique four-day event provides a substantial boost to the UK television export industry as a whole, and British TV was the shining star of the event, showing countries around the world that we're up there with the USA as a leading international TV producer. Among the delegates was Julian Hector, head of the BBC Natural History Unit. He spoke about why he enjoyed being in Liverpool for the event.
I mean, the waterside here on the Mersey in Liverpool is absolutely spectacular, you know, and you've got this great history in Liverpool, particularly Liverpool, of pointing west, you know, of the sort of history of Great Britain. And I think also very poignantly, you know, there's, you know, just next door to here, there's a big museum of slavery. All those buildings that go down the Mersey, the front here, are all buildings of empire, all in our history, and history that we aren't necessarily that proud of. And so I think it shows that, you know, Great Britain has got this enormous sort of cultural heritage. And the more our sort of guests, as it were, our visitors from all over the world, can see, you know, the fabric of Britain, the better.
The BBC stands for all of the UK and should include everyone, whatever their background. Recently, the corporation has been trying to push this more than ever. Julian Hector continued about how he thinks this isn't coming across very well in natural history programming.
In my particular genre, I think we're doing less well in natural history. And I think it's beyond the, you know, the BBC just reflects the real world, really, and Natural History Unit reflects the real world. And I think there's not as much representation and sort of diversity representation and inclusion in natural history across the whole sector. You know, I think there should be greater diversity in the people that we're hearing on radio talking about natural history, greater diversity with the people that we're seeing in vision on television. But you know, you do that sort of thing carefully, because it's all that what's so important with natural history broadcasting is that people are authentic. You know, they need to know, you know, from a BBC point of view, you know, what they're talking about. You believe them. And so that is, in some ways, that's beyond diversity. It's about, you know, it's about who knows all that stuff. But the other side of the coin is that across the BBC, but in natural history, my bit, you know, we have to make sure that a greater diverse group of people are actually making it as well. You know, so there are different perspectives on the natural world.
Grant Welland, the Executive Vice President of CEMA, which is for the Central and Eastern Europe areas, spoke about why he also thinks diversity is so important.
The BBC is obviously funded by everybody. It's a universal licence fee, so it needs to provide something for everybody. But also it should just reflect the country, you know, the diverse cultures that we have. So I think it's absolutely right that we should do that. And it's important. It's important to us, I think, that to ensure that, you know, because everybody has to pay the licence fee, they don't get a choice. So I think it's very important that we're providing everybody with value. And we always need to be mindful of that.
With the rise of internet services such as Netflix and iPlayer, it is sometimes questioned how long television will last. A statement came out at the end of last year saying that Planet Earth attracted more viewers than The X Factor. Julian Hector, who works closely with the show, and had great things to say about that.
Fab! That's what I think. Thank you, that's so brilliant. And my first thought, actually, was a really lovely thought, and that is that that television ain't dead. And just, do you know, nearly half the country watched Planet Earth 2. So just under, I think it was 32 million in the end, watched it. Amazing. And so to me, what that said was that younger people were so euphemistically sitting down on the sofa. They're making a point to view telly. So it's a lovely feeling that telly's far from dead when you have something really great like that. I think Sir David Attenborough is just so cool. And I think young people want to see really beautiful stuff, and like everybody, they want to take some sanctuary, you know, in the natural world. I really do think that.
The BBC World Wide Showcase is the largest event of its kind and will continue to be hosted in Liverpool for the next 2 years.
Some great stuff from Lissy there. Well, also in the BBC, the cutting edge of the latest technological innovations in broadcasting, with the major research centre here in the Northwest. It's not just about how programmes are made and transmitted, as Richard Ridden has been finding out. We could be just a few years from a whole range of programmes being tailored to our individual moods and even lives.
Thank you for connecting to this BBC research and development experiment into new editorial formats. We hope you'll provide us with some feedback.
We've all done it, haven't we? Separately and together. Hundreds of times. We've sat down, we've slumped, let's be honest, in front of the TV of an evening, looking forward to a drama, a nice bit of diversion. We get lost in it. But what if that drama, the music, the lighting, even the characters and location changed to meet our different moods, our personalities, our interactions, and our background? Okay, it's a BBC thing, so cue someone from the corporation to explain more.
Our visual perceptive media project explores how to make content that is truly personal to you, changing to suit your preferences and aspects of your personality. The process of creating this adaptive content starts with a dedicated mobile app. Through data obtained from content like your listening habits and questions about your personality, a profile is built and stored in the cloud that the visual perceptive media web client can access to alter different aspects of the resulting film. The answers you give to the questions will shape the narrative flow of the film, as will aspects like your age and gender. The action may change in some scenes, or the shot may favour one character over another. Some scenes may be missing entirely.
Ian Forrester is a senior fire starter. No, he's not an arsonist, so far as I know. That's the title he gave himself. He's, you know, one of these that's really at the cutting edge of everything that's going on in BBC research and development, based at Media City in Salford. And recently he came along to the Liverpool Screen School and gave us a presentation. It was pretty gobsmacking, I have to tell you. And afterwards, I caught up with him. He told me that the ideas that he and his team are developing are not going to result in the broadcasting equivalent of the infamous social media echo chamber, where we surround ourselves only with people of like mind. No, no, the BBC is going to challenge us.
You may want to just slowly take them out of their comfort zone, rather than show them something completely shocking that really kind of turns them off and they go, I don't want to even engage in that. And that's the interesting part, is that if you have to understand a little bit about the user or the users, and then you can start to do more.
Doesn't this get away from the idea of broadcasting, though, that it's broadcasting, it's one to many, and that we all receive the same thing at the same time, whatever our background, whatever our culture, we're almost forced to understand another person's point of view and perspective?
Yeah, from a BBC point of view, we will definitely be pushing very hard for people to experience things which are a little bit out of their comfort zone. You know, that's part of our remit, is to show people this other kind of reality that they may not experience in daily life. I think it depends on what you are trying to achieve. If you are trying to achieve engagement and levels of engagement which make people kind of sit up and go, wow, that was incredible, that really touched me, I really felt for that character, then you will. If you just want eyeballs, you know, like a lot of the on-demand services, then probably not. You just go on doing the same kind of middle-of-the-road stuff, which will get lots of people because it's middle of the road. But the stuff that's really kind of like turning people to their partners and to their friends and saying, wow, I did not know, or the stuff that people talk about, you know, that's the stuff that I think will make people want to do this kind of thing.
Data that reflects your general outlook will affect the appearance of the film. Meanwhile, individual media preferences, like listening history, will shape the film's score. At the moment, all the data is generated by the mobile app. However, in the future, the data could be generated by any number of services, and the object-based nature of perceptive media means it could respond to a user's mood in real time. The results are one film that can be tailored for everyone's individual preferences, and can give different repeat viewing experiences depending on factors like your location, the time of day, and your mood.
Another development is the way that different versions of news stories and other factual material can be edited and reversioned. Yeah, I know they can do that at the moment, but this is taking it to a different level. It sounds great, brilliant for editors and production staff, but clearly could be put into the wrong hands, a very dangerous thing indeed. Wasn't the BBC worried about that?
It does keep me awake, but well, it used to keep me awake. Someone's going to do this, and it's better that we do it in an open manner that allows people to go ahead and do the kind of crazy stuff that we're not even going to touch. But the core technology is open so that you'll get those examples where, you know, what we'll do, where, you know, it's a cooking show that fits with you and works with what you're doing, and dramas that work and, you know, that kind of thing. But you'll also get the stuff that's like, you know, kind of Minority Report, kind of like crazy advertising. I mean, when we first talked about perceptive media, for example, the first people that got in touch were advertisers, because they instantly saw, this is what they've been trying to do, but
tailor their advert specifically for a particular person demographic.
Yeah, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. We could try and like make the technology just all about us, but then we'd ruin the potential. And also, someone will always kind of create something very similar. They will engage and they will consider it, and they will, you know, things will actually happen from it.
Okay, here's another scenario. You're listening to a radio drama. Yeah, got a bit of time. You're doing a bit of ironing, maybe, some housework. All of a sudden, the phone goes, or a neighbour pops round. Well, normally you'd have to pause or switch the thing off completely and maybe go back to listen to it later on the radio iPlayer. But no more, no. With the new form of perception radio being developed by BBC R&D, you can continue to listen to the drama. You see, they'll just put some background noise on, or the characters sort of muttering to each other in the background while you deal with the call or the neighbour. And then they'll know when you've finished that call and that chat, and they'll pick up in the drama exactly where you left off. Clever stuff. Here's one of the dramas that they're developing.
Come on, come on, come on.
Doors opening. Doors closing. Lift going down.
I can do this. I can do this. Oh, God, no. No, I can't do this. Stop. Stop. I can't do this. Stop. Oh. Okay. Up. Up, 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 up. Ow! Stupid machine!
Charming.
What?
I'm trying my best.
Oh, great. Now I'm hearing voices. As if I wasn't mad enough.
We call it neutral, because it's like the engine's still running. The pause is so aggressive. It's like, I want this now pause. I don't want to hear anything. That doesn't work. If your phone goes and you've got other people in the room, what are they going to listen to? Silence. Listen to your call. You have to run out of the room and, you know, actually, could it be something a little bit more kind of like a human talking, you know? So your phone goes, your friend's talking, your friend goes a little bit more quieter, just to like observe a bit of more, you know, so you can hear the other person on the phone, but doesn't go into any depth about something else because they're waiting for you to like get off the phone. They might kind of drab on about something completely different. And it's those kind of things that we're exploring. There's ways to engage an audience in a living room which don't require a screen. And it could be your lights, it could be your thermostat, it could be all types of other things. But that's
the Internet of Things we hear so much about now.
Yeah, that is the Internet of Things, and that opens up a whole bunch of new possibilities. So whenever I hear the Amazon Echo or Alexa, it kind of winds me up because it's very much, I tell it to do something, it does something. Where there could be such amazing experiences which are, if it was using object-based media, you could tell it, tell a bedtime story, but it's be read to a child. So the child gets something which is like something which fits, but if you tell it, you know, tell us a bedtime story, and you're talking to some adults, you get something slightly different, and you get the music that may reflect music that you prefer. These are just wild thoughts off the top of my head, but the idea of just this thing that just responds to you just seems a bit underrated or underwhelming.
Okay, calm down, Harriet. You can get out.
Hello?
I'm stuck in the lift near the third floor. Can you get me out, please? Quickly.
My engineers will be a few minutes.
Oh, okay. Could you stay? Thanks for that.
You do not seem mad.
Perfectly normal. I just can't leave my flat, and I discuss psychology with lifts.
You have left your flat.
And look where that got me. I can't breathe. My heart's going to explode.
That is unfortunate.
Unfortunate?
Do not explode.
I was being figurative.
You are being irrational.
Look, I'm really panicking, okay? I need to get out of here.
Lift going down.
No! Don't go down!
If you want me to give you an actual timescale, it's difficult to say. I mean, like, I think you'll start to see some stuff in radio. I'm already talking to local radio about this stuff because audio is a lot easier to manipulate and do some interesting stuff with. And there's also a demand that, you know, especially because all these devices are internet connected, most people's phones are internet connected, you'll start to see that it will just become a sweet spot. But if you want a time, an actual date, I don't know, but I reckon the next...
Ballpark, 3 years, 5 years,
next three,
10 years?
Next 3 years, I wouldn't be surprised if we see, for example, a perspective podcast of some kind or more actual live audio or some kind of drama from like a big radio station, probably around just a little bit after that. Yeah, not okay. long.
And you are a real evangelist for this. I mean, it's the end of the day now, we're talking. You've given quite a long talk. You've answered a lot of questions. You've done a radio interview. You're thinking about getting your train home, I know. But, I mean, you are so enthusiastic about this, aren't you?
I'm enthusiastic because, I mean, I chose to work for BBC because I felt that the BBC... I've been working for BBC for 13 years. I do think that the BBC is, you know, kind of uniquely positioned to do this kind of stuff. And I could see instantly from a commercial point of view all the others going, well, let's just do the mass stuff because that's what gets us the eyeballs. But I think that there is something around... There's a role that the public service broadcaster has, and it's a very important role, especially in this day and age. And I think that this stuff really makes a difference.
Well, I reckon we'll still be wanting to slump in front of the TV or relax to the radio without, you know, any other funny business going on for some time yet. But these developments are coming and, well, maybe you heard it here first. If you want to listen to that experimental radio drama in full that we've been playing clips from today, you can go to the Future Broadcast site. That's www.futurebroadcasts.com. futurebroadcasts.com. And for other amazing stuff that the BBC research and development people are doing, just search for BBC R&D.
Richard Ridden reporting there, and he was talking to Ian Forrester of the BBC Research and Development based in Salford. Well, at the moment in the studio, I'm actually just taking a look at this week's Liverpool Life magazine. I've had a good flick through there, and there are some great stories to be read. Something for everyone, something to interest everyone. One story that I have noticed just as soon as I've actually opened the first page of the magazine was an article on the redevelopment set for the Beatles' Strawberry Fields. I'm not from Liverpool myself, but I actually took a visit to see the iconic gates on Tuesday, and I was taken back on the amount of people who visit these iconic gates and get pictures taken, people of all ages and from all over the country. The history behind the gates are what actually made them stand out for me. I hadn't been aware that the legend John Lennon had actually lived there in the children's home that was built for respite many years ago. And I found it slightly creepy and a little bit strange at how his family home was only just a stone throw away. I visited there as well for the first time, so I'm doing a little sightseeing in Liverpool. But no, this project will, in my opinion, be a major development for Liverpool. The new development, I must say, will be open for children with learning disabilities to help them develop their skills and gain real-life work experience. I think that it'll be a real asset for Liverpool, this redevelopment, but I think I'll have to broaden my horizons a little bit more and involve myself and a little more sightseeing, but I loved it. I loved it. And I got a picture there as well. remember, folks, you can pick up your own free copy from the LGMU's Redmond's building on Brownlow Hill on any weekday. But it's also available online with special software that allows you to see all of the content. Just go on to jmu-journalism.org.uk and click on the link Read All About It to see the latest issue.
This is the Liverpool Live podcast. For the latest updates anytime, follow us on Twitter at JMU Journalism.
Now, UKIP leader Paul Nuttall is on the receiving end of a growing backlash after claims that he had lost a close personal friend at Hillsborough which later turned out to be false. Nuttall has publicly condemned party donor Aaron Banks for his comment about Hillsborough. Two UKIP officials in the Liverpool and Merseyside have since resigned from the party, claiming that Paul Nuttall and donor Aaron Banks showed crass insensitivity about the 1989 disaster. The future of local UKIP leader Paul Nuttall is now under question. The question is, has he lost his loyalty in Liverpool? Well, our reporter, Car Hunter, spoke to John Tong of the politics department at the University of Liverpool to hear his political thoughts on where UKIP might go from here and the future of Mr. Nuttall in the Merseyside area.
On Merseyside, UKIP doesn't have a future. They were never doing well on Merseyside anyway. No councillors, no members of parliament. And frankly, they haven't got a future on Merseyside. In terms of the rest of the country, they still have a chance of winning the Stoke Central by-election this Thursday. And they're still in the European Union as a country. They will contribute to the debate over the terms of Brexit, advocating a hard Brexit. So they still have a political role to play, although the vast bulk of that will be beyond Parliament because they only have one MP at present. So it's only on Merseyside that they're effectively finished politically. They still have a role more broadly within the country.
Mm-hmm. UKIP doesn't do as well in Liverpool, unlike most northern cities. Why do you think that is?
Liverpool's a Remain city. 58% of people voted to remain in the European Union in Liverpool in the referendum last June. That's actually in common with most northern cities. Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds all voted to remain in the European Union. The size of the Remain vote was a bit larger in Liverpool compared to some other northern large northern cities. It's as soon as you get outside the big cities that you find the big Leave vote, and it's there that UKIP is much stronger politically, not necessarily in terms of votes, but in terms of political influence. UKIP has always performed poorly on Merseyside, and I never thought that changing the leader from Farage to Paul Nuttall, even though he's from Merseyside, necessarily reshaped that. The fact is that there's a very strong brand loyalty to the Labour Party in most parts of Merseyside, and therefore people don't switch from the Labour Party.
And so you think this is it? It's so damaging, there's no way back?
Well, given that many people in Merseyside have been boycotting the Sun since Hillsborough in 1989, and where's the evidence that they're likely to be sympathetic to UKIP, given the comments? I actually don't think it's that much about Paul Nuttall's website, although that certainly matters. It seems a bizarre claim to say that you lost loved ones at Hillsborough when you actually didn't. But Aaron Banks' comments, that he's UKIP's main donor, to say that people have been milking it, I think that is the most damaging thing of all. And if you put the two together, why would you, as a citizen of Liverpool, inclined to go and vote for UKIP, given those comments? I just don't see that at all. It's taken the Conservatives long enough to recover from the Thatcher era on Merseyside, but at least she never said anything offensive about Liverpool and its citizens. So I just think these comments are beyond the pale, and I'm not even sure that an apology now from Aaron Banks as UKIP's donor would necessarily change that. And I think it's recognised as well, in fairness to them, the two UKIP officials on Merseyside recognise the terrible predicament for their party, and that's why they've resigned, because they can see the damage that has been done. They wouldn't have resigned, perhaps, if damage wasn't so evident.
Some interesting points there made by Mr. Tong. Thank you.
This is the Liverpool Life Podcast. For all the latest news, sport and features anytime, click on to the JMU Journalism multimedia website, jmu-journalism.org.uk. Bookmarkers and come back often.
Liverpool have joined in with other parts of the country as protests continued over the proposed state visit for Donald Trump, which is scheduled, of course, for later this year. Demonstrations have been taking place in the UK in support of migrants after Trump's proposed travel ban continues to cause controversy. Tom Begbie has more on this.
Protesters took to the streets of Liverpool throughout Monday to protest the Trump administration and the government austerity measures. It came as a petition looking to ban Donald Trump's state visit hit 1.8 million, and a day before MPs debated Donald Trump's visit in Westminster, which ended with the Foreign Office Minister Sir Alan Duncan saying this.
The visit should happen, the visit will happen, and when it does, I trust that the United Kingdom will extend a polite and generous welcome to President Donald Trump.
At the protest, the regional organiser for the Socialist Party, Hugh Caffrey, said that Liverpool was subject of the right wing trying to divide the city as government cuts continue to hit hard.
Look around Liverpool now, and with the exception of the city centre, you see a city that's getting poorer, a city that's more fearful of the future, a city that the establishment would like to be more divided. The far right keep targeting Liverpool.
Now for a roundup of our sporting news, here's our reporter Nathan Archer with more.
Thanks, Natalie, and hello. This week we saw the first signs of the new talent currently being developed at Everton. The Blues under-23s team played before a packed crowd and moved a step closer to the Premier League 2 title after winning 2-0 over Southampton. Liam Walsh scored first, but the young Blues had to wait until 9 minutes from time to double their lead when Kieran Dow fired home from outside the box. So is this new team going to revive Everton's first team fortunes? Our sports correspondent Rebecca Cleverly joins me on the phone. Rebecca, hello to you. Who is standing out at the moment in the under-23s team?
Well, it's quite a good one, actually, because the Everton under-23s team have quite a lot of good talent come up through the academy. Everton are always quite good at bringing up players. So Liam Walsh, obviously, he scored early in the fourth minute on Monday. He's only 19, scored from the halfway line. He's played in the under-28s match against Derby in 2015. He's progressed through the academy. He's one to watch out for. And Kieran Dowell as well, the second scorer. Only 19 again. He joined the Everton Academy age 7 and he's also on the England under 20 team. So I think there's quite a few players that you could definitely watch out for, and it's quite an exciting team at the moment.
Ronald Koeman was at the match on Monday. How close is he going to be looking at the under 23s team for new talent?
I think massively, especially with the likes of Luckman and Davis now in the First League Premier team. Koeman is definitely more open to playing younger players, and he originally said that a match against Southampton, that he would never play younger players, but with the breakthrough that we've got at the minute, I think he's definitely open to that idea now. I mean, he's played Dominic Calvert-Lewin in matches before and Mason Holgate, all young players. Also, there was a tweet from Everton hero Peter Reid saying how impressed he was by the new players or the young players on Monday, so I think it's definitely something to watch out for.
And the press made a big thing about the attendance at the match. 6,000 players watching at Goodison Park on Monday. Do you think the fans are excited, Rebecca, about this new talent?
Yeah, definitely. I think what Everton do is quite good. I mean, the match was free for all Everton supporters, just for that idea to get behind the younger team and to give them encouragement. And I think it's a great thing for fans to be able to go along to games like these, watch the new talent, and it definitely gives them hope for the future.
Rebecca Cleverly, our sports correspondent. Thank you. Tranmere are currently now just 4 points off the top of the National Conference. Tuesday 21st saw them beat Boreham Wood 2-1 with a goal from Andy Cook just 33 seconds into the game. The return to league football for the Super White Army will be a return to form after the club dropped out of League Two in 2015. Now, the women's rugby union team at Liverpool John Moores University is one game away from lifting the Northern Conference Cup. Following a win against Teesside, the team remain unbeaten all season. They face the University of Central Lancashire in the semi-final next week before hopefully taking the title the first time in 7 years. And player Anne Allen joins me now on the phone. Anne, hello to you.
Hello.
How are you doing? So, first things, massive congratulations.
Thank you.
Unbeaten all season, and you're playing in the team in your first year. What's it like to do that?
It's been really good. Like, I've played rugby like most of my life, but to be able to take it on like further at university and kind of take it to a higher level is like, it's really good. It's really good.
So what's the feeling about the team about as we move closer towards the end of the season?
We're all getting quite nervous, but also excited to actually get this far. you know, has been really amazing. And it's just kind of been really motivating and pushing us forward. But we're all getting quite nervous for the end of it now.
Could you just explain for our listeners who aren't familiar with the university leagues, what's the system? How does it work?
Yeah, so we play in the league first, which is, we play, I think it's 3A's. And so we played all of those matches and we won that league. And then now we have cup matches as well. So the cup is, it's a bit more serious. It's the teams are going to be harder because it's like a lot more competitive. So the league's over, so now we're still in the cup. So the league goes mostly off points. So you'll get like bonus points for the amount of tries that you score and the try difference in the scoreline and stuff like that.
And obviously university sport is a great grounding for going on to professional sport. Where do you do you see yourself and your colleagues doing this more full time after uni?
Yeah, like for definite. We've got a lot of really good players and a lot of players that do play for teams like outside of university. And yeah, I think like it really gives you an insight into what it would be like to take on like a lot more seriously. And it really does like make you think, you know, this is something I want to do like in the long run. But yeah, there's definitely, for a lot of us, we definitely want to do it after university for even higher teams. If we could, that would be great, you know.
Well, Anne, we wish you all the best of luck here in the journalism department, which doesn't count for anything really. But have a fantastic rest of the season and hope the cup goes well.
Thank you very much.
Anne Allen from the JMU women's rugby team speaking to me then. There's more sports news in the Liverpool Life newspaper, including a full match report on the Tuesday Tranmere match and that women's rugby win. Head over to jmu-journalism.org.uk for all the latest reaction. That's all from me for now. Back to you, Natalie.
Thanks for that, Nathan. We wish the LGMU women's rugby team all of the best in their fight to win this year's cup. Great stuff. And this weekend in Liverpool will be your last chance to step into the Enchanted. Liverpool's St George's Hall are inviting visitors to discover the wintry forest scene, whisking them into the magical land of Narnia. The Narnia Adventure Experience will be running until this Saturday, the 25th of February. Also this Saturday, the Liverpool International Jazz Festival, Millifest, presents a very special Music for the Mind and Soul concert. The event is free and will be hosted at the Capstone Theatre in Liverpool. Well, that's all from this week's Liverpool Life podcast. An extended and special thank you to our guest reporter, Richard Rudden. Also, a special thanks to our day editor, Cara Hunter, and thank you as well to the rest of the team. Savannah Wild will be here with you next week, but for now, that's all from me. I'm Natalie McGill. Thank you for listening.
That was the Liverpool Live podcast, brought to you by the JMU Journalism broadcast team at Liverpool John Moores University. More next week.